Out flew the web and floated wide. The mirror cracked from side to side. "The curse is upon me," cried the Lady of Shalott. Hello, and welcome back to There's a Book for That, a podcast in which I, Rumbi, a bookworm, talk about books I have read and apply them to social issues in everyday life. This week, we're looking at love, in honor of the commercial love extravaganza that is Valentine's Day. I wasn't sure if I wanted to do this episode in the middle of the Valentine's Day week extravaganza, but then I decided to be mischievous and do it because why the hell not? Our book for today is The Lady of Shalott by Lord Alfred Tennyson, a well-to-do Englishman who was the poet laureate during much of Queen Victoria's reign, to give you an idea of both the time period in which he lived and his importance. I first encountered the story of the Lady of Shalott in a book called The Mirror Cracked by Agatha Christie. In it, someone dies, and Miss Marple, the resident detective, has to solve the murder. All that happened as usual, but there was this short stanza which was key to the story from the poem The Lady of Shalott. I was completely enchanted by the few lines that I read and spent ages trying them out in different inflections, trying to figure out what this lady would have sounded like, realizing that she was cursed and therefore doomed. As you heard at the beginning, I've not quite nailed it. How would she say it? She cries out, the narrator tells us. So you have to change your voice quickly between the two. "The curse is upon me," cried the Lady of Shalott. "The curse is upon me," cried the Lady of Shalott. "The curse is upon me." Out flew the web and floated wide. Is it dramatic? Out flew the web and floated wide. The mirror cracked from side to side. It sounds like I'm doing like a baseball advert. I'm advertising an off-road car. Out flew the web. I couldn't figure it out, but I just loved the sound of it. I loved the way that it rolled off the tongue, and so I wanted to read the whole poem and find out what happened next. I then found the book, a slim volume with illustrations, in the library at Thamesmead Community College, where I went to school. I think I was about 13. And maybe it was summer, because I seem to have a lot of time. The poem is 20 long stanzas, a full story told from start to finish. And I think it's about 8 or 10 lines per stanza, but I loved it so much that I copied the whole thing out from this beautiful hardback book. I copied it line by line onto multiple pieces of lined paper and then put them in my binder and just kept them there. I would read it every so often, trying to memorize it. I might still be at my mom's in neat faded handwriting. What a simpler life I led. I was such an interesting child. Today, in this podcast, I get to talk about this poem that I love so much. It's not the most fun story, which is why I was not sure if I wanted to talk about it today. But as we're talking about love, I think it's important for us to talk about unhealthy iterations of love. It's important for us to talk about how things can go wrong, how you can get lost in a dream that weaves you into itself like a spider's web. Once there, it's difficult to escape and you toss and turn, but all that happens is that you're getting more and more wound into it until eventually it stifles your breath, it stifles you, and you are no longer. This is so dramatic, I apologize. I'm going to try and keep the hyperbole to a minimum. But I'm hoping that as we talk about this subject today, as we think about the Lady of Shalott or Shally, we can learn from her life, the intensity of her experience and the futility of it all. At its heart, it's a story about the problem of loving too hard, of unrequited love and invisibility. In the words of Alicia Keys, it feels like, ooh, 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 you don't know my name. So let's rewind. This is fast becoming a conventional podcast, but I assure you it's just for this week. I'm not going to be doing this all the time. At 23, I had my first brush with ill-fated love. My mom was recovering from chemo, I was in the second year of university, finally, after multiple attempts, and I was ready for life to surprise me with good things. Then I met this man, and within 24 hours, I had lost my mind. The shame, the drama, the pain of those days comes back to me, and I can't but laugh. Oh, God, I had really lost my mind. I will, of course, blame it on being young and innocent, but I was so enamored of that man. Ugh. I lost perspective. Like, everything about him just seemed to set me on fire. I was like, this is it. This is my destiny. This is the one. It wasn't even a secret. Everybody knew, for reasons beyond my control, actually. That's not a fun part of the story, so we're not going to talk about it. But suffice it to say, I went from never thinking about marriage to picking up my wedding dress in a month. It was a lovely dress on a plus size model, so I could really see what it would look like on me. But there was one problem. This man seemed quite ambivalent about me. I don't think he knew about our wedding. He was a sailor, so he was away a lot. And like the sea, he had a lot of moods. I just wanted nice sunny days and calm waters. But it felt like every time that we spoke, I was meeting a new person. Still, I persevered. What did I know? I was young and dumb. I thought things would eventually work out. Nowadays, when I act decisively and could disqualify myself from playing people's mind games, people are always like, oh, Bimbi, why are you like this? Give people a chance. I am like this because I know from experience 100% of the time, if someone does not see your value from day one and act like you're valuable from day one, they're not going to have an epiphany on day 620. Maybe for other people it might work. Like I said in yesterday's episode, we have the single outlier of our friend Mavlut, who managed to rewrite his destiny while asleep. But that was a work of fiction. I have yet to see it in reality. So I was perplexed. Why was this person acting the way that I expected? Why was there hot and cold and then frost and then hot again? I hate inconsistency in people. It brings out the worst in me because I become paranoid. How do I know how to behave if I never know who I'll be dealing with, Jekyll or Hyde? So after a year, I directly asked and I received an indirect answer. To me, that's always a no. So I took my bruised heart and moved on. Looking back though, I lived so much of that year in my head. The dreams and hopes and plans I made felt real. I wanted them to happen, and as long as the hope was there, it was possible. There were times we made plans and he didn't turn up, not a word. And then it would turn out that he thought it was the next day or he had some emergency and didn't bother to communicate. Today's Rumbi would have blocked him and moved on within hours, but like I said, I was young and dumb. I lived so many dreams in my head, imagining what we would do when he came back from the sea. Oh gosh, I was so dumb. Looking back, I realized that I might have been trying to run away from my actual life. Maybe I just wanted something that was mine in the midst of all that chaos. And as we'll see in today's discussions of unhealthy obsession and limerence, this is frequently the case. Eventually, I concluded that what I was really in love with was the feeling of unrequitedness. It becomes an addiction at some point. It's what you're used to. I grew used to the anxiety and started to associate it with him. Today, if I feel even a whiff of that anxiety about anyone's feelings, I get my HR speech out and start wishing people well in their future endeavors. I refuse to live like that, but this, friends, is the story of the Lady of Shalott. A state of anxiety induced by the appearance of a man. And instead of accepting that people come and go, this was not the love of her life. He didn't even know she existed. She got stuck on her first love, infatuated, obsessed, as I'm sure many of us have been. But she couldn't escape it. And it led to her doom. Stuck in her little tower with nothing but images of the real and a loom for company, she was stuck in her head with nothing but dreams and hopes of what life could be. If only things were slightly different. I'm so glad that I read this story before I lived her life, but I'm disappointed with myself that having read her story a full decade before, I still fell into the same trap as our dear friend Shally. I think more of us live in dreams than we may like to admit. And I would like in today's episode to remind us that it's not healthy. As a fellow addict, I understand the attraction. You get caught up in the chase, in the dream. You're able to control the pace, the events. When you're living inside your head, you're able to imagine the worst and feel it and immunize yourself, as it were, to the worst that can happen. But none of it is real, so there are no real stakes. At the end of the day, you are safe. But what if that was your entire life? What if you were so tied into that life and couldn't escape it anymore? What if the pursuit of the real actually killed you? Let's go to our story. It's a poem, and I will read most of it today, so be prepared. I think there are a lot of beautiful lines which contribute to the telling of the story, and I want to make sure that we get all of them. Let's set the scene. The following is the background to our tale. Quote, on either side the river lie long fields of barley and of rye that clothe the world and meet the sky, and through the field the road runs by to many towered Camelot. And up and down the people go, gazing where the lilies blow, round an island there below, the island of Shalott. Willows whiten, aspens quiver, little breezes dusk and shiver, through the wave that runs forever by the island in the river, flowing down to Camelot. Four grey walls and four grey towers overlook a space of flowers, and the silent owl embowers the Lady of Shalott. End quote. All alone on a silent little island, all she can do is look down to Camelot, where the people are living their lives. Our poor young lady is stuck. She has no choice in the matter. We know not why or how. There are some who speak of her among the villagers, but no one can truly be sure she's there. And it's only the reapers working early in the morning. This is the Victorian age. There were a lot more people doing this kind of reaping jobs. So they're working outside. So occasionally they hear her sing and they call her a fairy. In, you know, referring to the make-believe personage shrouded in myth and mystery. Is she real or not? Nobody really knows. But what about her life? How does she spend her days? What is she doing embowered on the silent isle? Well, the poor thing, she's a captive of sorts. Again, we know not why. Quote, there she weaves by night and day a magic web with colors gay. She has heard a whisper say a curse is on her if she stay to look down to Camelot. She knows not what the curse may be, so she weaveth steadily, and little other care hath she, the Lady of Shalott. And moving through a mirror clear that hangs before her all the year, shadows of the world appear. There she sees the highway near, winding down to Camelot. There the river eddy whirls, and there the surly village churls and the red cloaks of market girls pass onward from Shalott. Sometimes a troop of damsels glad, an abbot on an embling pad, sometimes a curly shepherd lad, or a long-haired page in crimson clad, goes by to towered Camelot. And sometimes through the mirror blue, the knights come riding two and two. She hath no loyal knight and true, the Lady of Shalott. But in her web she still delights to weave the mirror's magic sights. For often through the silent nights, a funeral with plumes and lights and music went to Camelot. Or when the moon was overhead, it came two lovers lately wed. I'm half sick of shadows, said the Lady of Shalott. End quote. So, she has to weave images that she sees in her mirror day by day, and she's been told that a curse will come on her if she stays to look down at Camelot. First of all, why? What did poor Shelley do There is no hidden redemption in her fate except to mind her business, stick to her loom until she dies, watching other people live their best lives as though on TV. It would appear that Tennyson obviously envisioned the future that we're now living, where we watch other people living their lives, cooking, eating, sleeping, etc. But who would choose to live such a life without the option to get out there and do something worth watching yourself? Unlike, for example, the beast in Beauty and the Beast, who could recover his form if someone loved him or he loved them or whatever the story was, the Lady of Shalott has no get-out clothes. She watches other people live their lives in shadows like Plato's cave, although they were in a mirror, so presumably clear. But she says, "I'm half sick of shadows." Shadows or shades back in the day, her day, could also mean ghosts. And that's fitting because these people in the mirror are only half lives. She cannot be sure that they are real. She cannot interact with them. They only half exist. But to them, she doesn't exist at all. I would be sick of it too, girl. Unfortunately, I think a lot of women are encouraged to live for shadows. Growing up, we're encouraged to think about marriage and babies and weddings, as though we know anything about these things. All we see are other people's lives, and then only the good things, the propaganda intended to make you think that it will all be worthwhile. Even now, as people start to tell stories more publicly about how hard it all is, the pitfalls, the reality of it all, we are still encouraged not to look at the real and focus on the shadows. It will be worth it because it's yours, we are told, in the face of 1,000 red flags. We are sold the shadow of romance, but that's all it is. Unfortunately, as Valentine's Day proves, year on year, in the global wedding and marriage industry, the magazines, the diamond industry, the myth of 2 months' salary, people love shadows. Who doesn't love romance? I'm not making this podcast because I'm anti-romance. I'm all for it. I love love. I just think we need to redefine it so it actually works for everyone. And the first thing is to move away from the dreams of romance and into the reality of what it really means to love. You can listen to Monday's episode featuring The Prophet by Khalil Gibran. What does it mean to be in love, to be in a relationship? Really? Even as I say this, I'm rolling my eyes because who wants reality when you could have flowers and candy, holding hands, long walks on the beach and whatnot? Romance is not new. There have been stories of romance across the world and throughout the ages, and the world that our Shelley inhabits is no different. In fact, Tennyson's little rhyme has hidden a hint at what her life could have been like had she not been a captive on her little island. Quote, "And sometimes throw the mirror blue, the knights come riding two and two. She hath no loyal knight and true, the Lady of Shalott." End quote. Here's a little hidden history for us, at least my generous interpretation. So there was this idea back in the day of courtly love, and this basically meant that people were not necessarily getting married for love, especially among the rich. They, you know, needed something else to fill that hole. In those days, your parents might betroth you as a baby or as a young person to marry the prince or the duke or the princess or whatever, and you just kind of had to go along with it. But as a way of bringing some titillating excitement into the lives of the people, there was this idea of courtly love. This involved, for the royals, the knights, you know, landed gentry, these glorious fighting men who were the very image of valor and honor, what we might call today work husbands and wives. They would choose or be chosen by certain ladies at court, and they would serve these ladies wearing their tokens or colours when jousting and going to war and whatever else. It's all very Game of Thrones. Or fitting with the American tradition of wearing, you know, like the jock or the quarterback or whoever is playing on one of their football teams or those sports that they all play, their blazer. It's a way of saying, this one is mine, that you're claimed. But in all of that, everything still had to be kept very chaste because these were very godly Christian people. So it was all non-sexual. They just did it for the romance. They were writing letters, sending flowers, being dramatic, the little looks at dinner, whatever. It was all a part of it. So when Tennyson says she has no knight, it means that she doesn't even have access to that level of romance, which in itself is a shadow of the real. He's basically saying that she's alone, alone. Valentine is coming. Where's her boyfriend? Zero. Nobody. Nobody. Lonely. She's so lonely. Just nothing. It's just her and a loom. You know what a loom is? She's weaving on a... She's making tapestries of life. That's her life. Making tapestries of other people doing things. That stanza, connected to the next section, shows, at least for me, why it is that she falls so deeply in love and so suddenly. Our girl is doing her thing with her loom in the mirror, when in that mirror she sees this man. Quote, "A boa shot through her boa eaves. He rode between the barley sheaves. The sun came dazzling through the leaves and flamed upon the brazen greaves of bold Sir Lancelot. A red cross knight forever kneeled to a lady in his shield that sparkled on the yellow field beside remote Shalott." End quote. What, you may be wondering, is a red cross knight? I hope you're wondering, because I'm about to tell you. The Red Cross Knight is from the allegorical poem The Fairy Queen by Edmund Spenser, written during the first Elizabethan age, so before this epic poem that we're looking at today. The Red Cross Knight represents virtue, Christian virtues, such as temperance, being able to control yourself, holiness, chastity, zero body count, friendship, and justice. The Red Cross Knight is basically the embodiment of goodness or virtue in the Western world. They were the knights in pursuit of the Holy Grail, going to the Middle East to start wars for the Holy Land in the name of God. Look how little things have changed in all these hundreds of years. In Spenser's poem, well, you know, the story of... Yeah, sure, I'll go for it. You know the story of Othello? It's that with a Super Mario twist with Princess Peach doing the rescuing. Like, it's like Peach Melba, you know, that twist. Or Shrek. Basically, the knight is in love with a girl and she loves him too. But then somebody else is trying to keep them apart and that person is lying. And then he, the knight, gets all jealous and says something old-timey like, "This trollopy wench, this strumpet, she doesn't love me, she's not chaste." A nice virgin girl, because men have been obsessed with this virtue forever. Anyway, it turns out that she is chaste and she loves him, and that she rescues him from a scrape, and then they live happily ever after. Roughly. Their entire English departments that just caught fire from that description. But I only had time for Wikipedia, so... never mind. Don't write to me, I'm not going to read your letters. I'm sorry. Princess Peach. Anyway, Tennyson takes this idea of the Red Cross Knight, this virtuous man, and applies it to Lancelot, who was also one of the legendary fictional Knights of the Round Table. I remember when I first came from Zimbabwe and they were talking about King Arthur, and I didn't know that he wasn't a real king. Why do you talk about him so much if he's not real? Anyway... so basically, from that, we're supposed to know that Lancelot, as a Red Cross Knight, is, you know, he's a top guy. He's a good man. He's a good man, Savannah. He's, you know, a great guy squared. He's the best of the best of the best, yeah? So Shelley had a never, just no chance. As soon as she sees him, she's going to fall. That's what Tennyson wants us to know. He's a great guy. She's not just being silly. He's amazing. Quote, "His broad, clear brow in sunlight glowed. Now, for me personally, if someone said that my broad, clear brow was glowing in the sunlight, I hear you have a giant forehead. But apparently here, it means he's sexy. I'm going to continue the quote. His broad, clear brow in sunlight glowed. On burnished hooves. Maybe he looks like that guy from Community, you know, with the big forehead. Like, he's meant to be really good looking and stuff, but he does have a giant forehead. So maybe that's what we're imagining for Lancelot here. Quote, his broad, clear brow in sunlight glowed. Maybe he's East African, we don't know. Anyway, his broad, clear brow in sunlight glowed. On burnished hooves, his warhorse strode. From underneath his helmet flowed his coal black curls as on he rode. As he rode down to Camelot, from the bank and from the river, he'd flashed into the crystal mirror. Tira-li-ra by the river, sang Sir Lancelot. End quote. Shay. Oh, this poor lady. From the moment that she saw him in that mirror, it was over for her. I get it, girl. Sometimes you meet someone and it's like that. But you know what? It's hardly ever good news. I am team slow burn. And this story is exactly the opposite of that. He was handsome. He could sing. He's riding a horse. He's a whole ass knight. Damn. If love is gonna kill you, you should at least be able to justify it 300 years later. And our lady called. 100%. Nobody's looking at Lancelot and thinking, I don't get it. We get it. Except for one thing. This man had no idea she existed. And I just think that's kind of important. I think that's what really makes me so sad about this story. And maybe these kind of situations in general, having been in her shoes. The general problem with unrequited love is how unbothered the object of the love is. He doesn't know. In the Alicia Keys song, You Don't Know My Name, she goes on and on about him not knowing her name. And yet on the other side, she's convinced that this is a coupling that could work. Delulu is the only word that we can use to describe the state of having feelings for someone who doesn't know you exist. It's a parasocial relationship, and it's about as real as me calling myself Mrs. David Boreanaz when I was 15. It's not real. The Lady of Shalott throws her life away upon seeing Lancelot in her crystal mirror. It's a one-way mirror in which only she can see him, but his world continues unmoved. For her, though, it's instant. There's barely a moment's thought, and we finally see what it means to stay to look down to Camelot. Quote, she left the web, she left the loom. She made three paces through the room. She saw the water lily bloom. She saw the helmet and the plume. She looked down to Camelot. Out flew the web and floated wide. The mirror cracked from side to side. The curse has come upon me, cried the Lady of Shalott. The drama. I still feel it now, over 20 years since the first time. This is a masterpiece. Morgul was just living her life, and then this man came along and ruined everything forever. Within 2 seconds, the curse was upon her, and her doom was sealed. Women really suffer in life, especially for love. My sisters, be careful. Don't give it all up for Lancelot, especially when he doesn't even know your name. In that moment, her life broke, and all for a dream. I would like to take the time to self-diagnose my illness, as well as that of my old friend Shelley. According to the lady who coined the word in the 70s, Dorothy Tenov, a psychologist, liberance is, quote, not love. It is the force of evolution expressed as the compulsion for the particular, this particular one, above all others. Often, it is called love, end quote. She continues, limerence occurs across sexual, racial, age, cultural, and other categories. It also follows immutable rules. It endures as long as do the conditions that sustain both hope and uncertainty. End quote. All well and good. Excellent. Thank you. But what is she talking about? What is limerence? So she says that it is first and foremost a condition of cognitive obsession. Right. I'm going to make that simpler and say that it's a runaway crush. You know, when you're thinking about somebody and they're in your head and you can't get them out of your head and you're trying to get them out of your head, but they just live there. They've moved in. They're not going anywhere. But, and this is very important, on the other side of it, you know they're not feeling the same way. You only hope they are, but you pretty much know. When you find yourself having real feelings for someone that you don't actually know, you can't get them out of your head, you can't stop thinking or talking about them with nothing coming back, you might be caught in the limerent loop. Dorothy Tenoff goes on to describe the basic components of limerence. She got these basic components because she was a teacher at university and she had a bunch of students who were coming in with what we can only call heart sickness, right? They were in love, or they wanted to be in love, or they loved somebody and that person wasn't doing what they wanted, or they'd broken up and they were struggling to cope. These students were failing to turn up at school. They were failing to turn in their assignments. They couldn't think. They couldn't eat. And she was fascinated by this. She wanted to study this phenomenon. And so she spoke to 500 couples. This was in the 70s. And that research is what she then based the book on. The book is called Love and Limerence. And it's available on Google Books, most of it. On page 23 is where she talks about the actual components of limerence. I have a quick summary because I'm not going to tell you all of them. But here are what I thought were the most significant ones. Quote, intrusive thinking. Well, not quote. This is not a quote. This is a summary. Number one, intrusive thinking about the subject of the object of your passionate desire. Acute longing for super reciprocation. Dependency of mood. This is the worst one. Like, I'm going, when I went through the list, I was like, I lived this life. But dependency of mood on the limerent object's actions, or more accurately, your interpretation, because it's all in your head. I would have bad days because of what somebody else did, or I thought they were ignoring me, or I thought that they said something that I didn't want to hear. Just let this nonsense go, please. Just stop. Some fleeting or transient relief from unrequited limerent passion through vivid imagination or action by your crush. So you imagine that they do something and that makes you feel better because you're basically having a whole relationship in your head. Which is why sometimes if you do actually meet with them, the actual relationship is disappointing. I talk about limerence and these kind of mental projections that we have, this maladaptive daydreaming that we do with respect to the Lady of Shalott, because there's no reason when you read the whole poem for her to feel as strongly as she does about Lancelot. She's literally only seen his helmet and his helmet feather, his plume. There's nothing there. He doesn't know her. She's not even really seen his face. And yet there's a hope. And this is the problem. There's a hope that takes over her. Hope is that thing with feathers that causes you to lose your mind. There's a hope that makes it enough for her to think that this is something that she wants and is going to pursue. 5, the inability to react limerently to more than one person at a time. And this pisses me off so much because it means that basically you're in a monogamous relationship with your head. This also in turn makes you unable to respond positively to people who might actually like you in real life. With limerence, the same kind of thing. This is what's happening in your head. Everything is in your head. It's your imagination. You're having a relationship with imagination. Have you seen that SpongeBob meme where he's just like, imagination? Yes, that's what's happening with this relationship. There's nothing actually real, but it's enough for you to pursue your limerent object, your crush, that person that you want to be in this relationship with, even to your death, as is the case with our friend Shally. Other things that Tenoff says are components of this runaway crush that cause havoc are an aching of the heart. So this is what her students were experiencing that made her worried. You have actual physical symptoms. One might also experience a general intensity of feeling that leaves other concerns in the background, like their studies, and remarkable ability to emphasize what is truly admirable in the limerent crush. And avoid dwelling on the negative. So basically, you're just like, no, they're wonderful. Prince Charming. This is where you start to make excuses for why the person doesn't love you or treat you how you want to be treated, even as you want that. Tenoff describes a couple in which the lady describes her feelings for her love, saying, quote, yes, I knew he gambled. I knew he sometimes drank too much. And I knew he didn't read a book from one year to the next. I knew, and I didn't know. I knew it, but I didn't incorporate it into the overall image. She basically just ignored what she didn't want. Reading through the descriptions of the components of limerence. Yes, I did go through all of those with that sailor man. But I'm delivered now. Alhamdulillah. Praise God. According to Shaver and Hazan, social psychologists working in this area of attachment theory, who also built on Tenev's work, quote, those suffering from loneliness are significantly more susceptible to limerence. They state that, quote, if people have a large number of unmet social needs and are not aware of this, then a sign that someone else might be interested is easily built up in that person's imagination into far more than the friendly social contact that it might have been. Again, imagination. By dwelling on the memory of that social contact, the lonely person comes to magnify it into a deep emotional experience, which may be quite different from the reality of the event. End quote. Who is lonelier than a young woman with a mirror and a loom for company? Or a single girl who has spent the past year trying to hold it all together while watching her mother battle cancer? Limerence is not a response of healthy, happy people. And if you're caught in the cycle, thinking about someone on a loop, unable to break out, whether or not they show you any affection, well, you're in danger, friend. Loneliness is breaking you and it's time to talk to someone. It's not healthy to live out a whole relationship in your head. Come back to us, please. Part of the reason why limerence is separated from love in Dorothy Tenno's theory, and why I also separate it from myself, or at least I try to, looking back on myself as a 23-year-old, is because there's so little that you know about this person and so much of it is in your head. I recently spoke to my limerence crush after a long time, and I got off the phone and I was like, this is the same person that I knew back then, and I'm not that same person. But it feels like that because I never knew them. I didn't know this person. Or maybe I did and that's all there was and it was never going to be enough. Either way, a lot of it was so much in my head that I didn't really know them. I was going around, this is how this person is going to treat me. This is how they're going to feel about me. This is what we're going to do. This is where we're going to go. But none of it was real. And even if it did happen, because sometimes we would meet, it would always be anticlimactic. And I regularly experienced this back then. After spending weeks imagining sunset beach level storylines, there was simply no way that this man could compete. He didn't even know that he was competing with Sunset Beach. It was always going to be disappointing. The reason why I wanted to talk about the Lady of Shalott and the reason why she's stuck in my mind for 25 years, because I'm old, is because I've always been struck by how much she was the agent of her own undoing. Obviously, she doesn't know what the curse is, but she knows it exists. She knows that if she stay to look down at Camelot, the curse will come upon her. Stay here has two meanings, but I always take one. You can stay your hands, that's one. Or you can stay your anger, which means to control yourself. You don't let it overtake you. But we know she has no self-control. She meets a man 2 minutes later. She's dead. So it's obviously not that one. Option B is to stay physically, to remain. For me, reading that the curse will come down on her if she stays and thinking about the religiosity of the people at the time, I associate the curse and the admonition not to stay to look down at Camelot with the curse at Lot's wife in the Bible. Lot's wife was told not to go to look back at the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, which had been cursed or sentenced to death by God. Some religious scholars have said that it's not the actual act of looking back, but it's the act of looking back with longing that was the issue. It's not where her eyes were, but where her heart was. Lot's wife wanted to go back to Gomorrah. She wanted her life back because, you know, that's where she'd been living all her life. All her friends were there. You know, she probably had a little business. She was happy there. She looked back at the life that she was living, and that's what made God turn her into a pillar of salt, because she wasn't ready to let go. She stayed her heart in Sodom and Gomorrah, or her heart stayed there. I believe this is the same kind of curse. Shelley doesn't just look down at Camelot in a fleeting way. She remains to look down at Camelot, leaves her heart there. She knows she shouldn't, but something catches her eye. And in that moment, looking at Lancelot in the mirror, she says, this is not enough, my life, my mirror, my shadows. Perhaps she wanted him to see her. She wanted a duet, both of them singing Tira Lira by the river. But unfortunately, the curse is fast acting. She stays. She lets her heart go down there and build a home for her in Lancelot. And with that, she's completely undone. One of the most astonishing things from this point is that she seems to instinctively know what to do next, and none of it is happy. In case she didn't know, she dies. Oh yes. As soon as she looks, that's it. She comes outside of her tower for the first time, like a bold Rapunzel, finds a little boat, writes her name on it, the Lady of Shalott, and sends a course to flow through Camelot. It's sort of like London with the river running through it, so the current bears her all the way down, and the villagers are obviously terrified to see this dead lady in a boat flowing down. But this is how it happens. Quote, "In the stormy east wind straining, the pale yellow woods were waning, the broad stream in his banks complaining, heavily the low sky raining, over towered Camelot. Down she came and found a boat, beneath a willow left afloat, and round the prow she wrote, the Lady of Shalott. And down the river's dim expanse, like some bold seer in a trance, seeing all his own mischance, With a glassy countenance, did she look down to Camelot. At the closing of the day, she loosed the chain and down she lay. The broad stream bore her far away, the Lady of Shalott. Lying robed in snowy white that loosely flew to left and right, the leaves upon her falling light, through the noises of the night, she floated down to Camelot. As the boat head wound along, the willowy hills and fields among, they heard her singing her last song, the Lady of Shalott. Heard a carol, mournful, holy, chanted loudly, chanted lowly, till her blood was frozen slowly, and her eyes were darkened wholly, turned to towered Camelot. For ere she reached upon the tide, the first house by the waterside, singing in her song she died, the Lady of Shalott. Under tower and balcony, by garden wall and gallery, a gleaming shape she floated by, dead pale between the houses high, silent into Camelot. Out upon the wharfs they came, knight and burgher, lord and dame, and round the prow they read her name, the Lady of Shalott." End quote. It's like when Boromir dies in The Lord of the Rings and they put him in the boat and they float him down so he can go home to Gondor. It's like that. Like the river, the current just carries you to your final destination and then they find you and they're like, oh no. Speaking of oh no, Lancelot sees her. Does he die? Does he cry? Does he know that she just died just so that she could see his silly helmet and feather? No, not at all. Listen to what Lancelot says eventually when he sees her poor dead body floating down the river. Okay, it's not even him. The villagers say this. Quote, "Who is this? And what is here? And in the lighted palace near died the sound of royal cheer, and they crossed themselves for fear, all the knights at Camelot. But Lancelot mused a little space. He said, she has a lovely face. God in his mercy lend her grace, the Lady of Shalott." Now, there are two versions of this poem, and I chose the longer version, which he did kind of like 20 years later after he released the original one. And the reason why I chose that one, A, because it's the version that I originally read, but also B, because you actually hear Lancelot speak. In the original, Lancelot doesn't say anything, and I wanted his voice to be in it so that we could at least hear what he has to say about this poor lady who's given up her life just so that she can see him. And he just says that she's got a lovely face. That's it. That's everything. Listen, if you've ever been the victim of unrequited love, don't bother trying to get compensation, because that's the best you're going to get. Sorrows, prayers. This man was unmoved, and his only thought in looking at her and her lovely face is, you know what? I might have moved to that if she was alive. Fuck you, Lancelot. In conclusion, gosh, I got so mad. I get so angry. Fuck you, Lancelot. Every Lancelot out there just doing mind games and role play, just stop it. Just say no, Emily. I don't like you. And just let Emily move on with her life. God damn it. Anyway, in conclusion, gosh, it was Emily. In conclusion, I want to finish by saying that to this day, I still consider my most healthy relationship to have been my shortest lived. I spoke about him in the episode on the Prophet, and honestly, it was great. In 2 weeks, I was wowed and dumped, but in the gentlest, most respectful way. Everything about the relationship stands out to me as holding a lot of what I would want if ever I decided to do relationships again. I remember noting at the time that the most important thing, or the thing that I enjoyed the most, the thing that I want to draw attention to right now, is how little I thought about him when I wasn't actually talking to him. I was working at Waitrose at the time, and I just mentally remember comparing the feeling of being in this relationship with being in that limerent state with the sailor. And it was just so refreshing. He said how he felt, I said how I felt. And then until we told each other differently, that was it. I didn't have to do any mental gymnastics or algebra to try and figure out what he wanted from me. I didn't have to try and contort my mind into Pythagoras theorems or anything. The communication was 100% with no games. Even when he was like, this is why this relationship isn't going to work out for me. He came, he told me to my face. We had a whole conversation. Everything was respectful. It was nice. I completely understand his point of view. And I was like, I get what you're saying. And this is why I can't do what you want me to do. Thank you so much. Everything just, yes, good. A lot of the times when we get stuck in limerence, what we're really trying to do is work through the lack of information that would enable us to make a decision. If I know my love loves me, then I can feel secure and focus on being happy. But as long as I'm not sure, as long as nothing has been said, then all I have are shadows and my imagination in which to torture myself and suffer as a result. As we think about love, about Valentine's, making commitments, I invite you to perhaps consider that if nothing has been said, if no commitments have been made, if the communication is opaque, then perhaps you're dealing with someone who's hedging their bets and is not going to be able to give you what you need. If you spend more time thinking about them than you do talking to them, you are in a relationship with yourself and you will be disappointed. You should not have to be a detective in your relationship, looking for clues that you're loved or cared for. Any relationship. This is not just about romance. If you aren't tripping over the clues, they don't exist. The web is still flying and floating wide, trapping us under its curse. But we can fight back. We can make the choice to look down at Camelot, curiously but without commitment. To look without staying, without leaving ourselves there. Unlike our friend Shally. Lancelot's helmet and plume and his pleasant song, Tira Lira, may catch our eyes and ears. But to lose your head over a man who doesn't know your name, how much they mean to you, I beg you, please. Let's declare a moratorium on that foolishness. It's all good when you're young and figuring things out, but once you stop being a teen, mind your business. If that man is going to wander the corridors of your mind, wearing out your floors, make sure he's building a home in his mind so you have somewhere to go. It also becomes an act of kindness to the other to let them go, release them from our expectations and our hopes, to see them as they really are, completely uninterested, completely different from what we imagine. When we let Lancelot go and let him live his life free of the knowledge that for us, he was our greatest hope and final demise, we allow him to live his life with the people of his own choosing. We then also liberate ourselves to choose, to love and be loved in the real world. Are you not half sick of shadows, of chasing dreams, of putting your hopes to sleep and waking up empty-handed? Liberate yourselves from the curse of unrequited love, of longing, of yearning. Be free, my sisters, please. I would say to finish that I focused on male-female relationships because I believe they have, well, I have the most experience with those. And I also believe that they have the most inequality and the least amount of open, honest communication, which makes everything that we've been talking about today much more likely to happen with terrible consequences. Reality isn't all that bad. Step out of the luminance and join us here. Don't go the way of the Lady of Shalott. Thank you for joining me on day 4 of our Valentine's Week extravaganza. Join me tomorrow to talk about our wild card book, another cautionary tale about the dangers of losing yourself in love, a French book, Mon Mari, by Maud Ventura. A bientôt.